Hello and welcome to the Guilty Pleasure Podcast, your monthly podcast looking at some of 21st century horror's guiltiest pleasures, as presented by New Horror Express and the Morbidly Beautiful Network. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and for this worst of the worst edition, we asked whether you wanted me and my guests to talk about 2003's House of the Dead or 2010's Birdemic. And by an overwhelming margin, you went with Uwe Boll's House of the Dead. So alongside me to talk about this trashster piece, we have Bloodhound Picks co-host, screenwriter, and friend of the show, Craig Draheim. Welcome, Craig.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Good as always. Yeah. And it seems only appropriate as we started this project as part of your podcast, hashtag Horror Not Fear campaign. So
yeah. And it's been a kind of a great way that we've definitely connected, and I think it brought others together, at least talking about guilty pleasures and other
things. It has.
Yeah.
It definitely has, indeed. And so, and before we got picked up by the Morbidly Beautiful Network, this was planned to be the final episode of the series, but now it will go on forever. And I deliberately picked this lineup because I thought, oh, won't it be funny to go out with the absolute bottom of the barrel? That'll be hilarious. I'm setting myself up for a fall, really. But yes, that was my thinking at the time.
So now we'll just see how much further down you can go.
There's really not much further down I can go unless we do actually cover Birdemic. Or I don't know if you've ever seen a film called The Incredible Bulk, but
I know of it. I don't know if I've seen it or not. I feel like I've seen clips of it, but
I can't
remember anymore. Probably blocked it out.
Yeah. There is slightly further we can go, but not much further. Anyway, back to the film. So some notes on House of the Dead before we get started. House of the Dead was released on the 10th of October 2003 and, as mentioned, was directed by notorious bad movie director and critic puncher Uwe Boll, and was written by Mark A. Altman, who doesn't have a whole lot of writing credits. He has more producing credits than writing credits, but he did go on to write the sequel to this film, House of the Dead 2. And he co-wrote the story with a guy called Dan Bates, who doesn't have any other writing credits, and co-wrote the screenplay with a guy called Dave Parker, who has more editor credits as an editor than as a writer. But the only other film that I recognized from his kind of writing credits was an anthology called Tales of Halloween from 2015. Okay. Review wise, whoa boy, we are at the bottom of the barrel. So it's currently sitting at a 2.0 out of 10 on IMDb, 3% on Rotten Tomatoes based on 61 reviews, 15 on Metacritic based on 15 reviews, and a 1.1 on Letterboxd. Plus, it is currently sitting at number 8 on the IMDb Bottom 100, uncomfortably sandwiched in between two Paris Hilton movies, The Haughty and the Naughty and National Lampoon's Pledge This. Not a position you want to find yourself in.
No.
Thankfully, I have seen neither of those movies, and I never plan to.
Except your next podcast venture.
covering crappy comedies from the 2000s. I feel like that'd be an even more depressing. I would just be so depressed, because if I'm just covering crappy 2000s comedies, then I would have to cover I'd have to cover things like Norbit, The Love Guru, Epic Movie. It'd just be I'd be so depressed, but I'd be like an alcoholic by the end of it. it would tip me over the edge. At least these are still quite fun. Like most of the Guilty Pleasure movies I cover on this series, for this series, are quite fun. And I'd rather rewatch this a bunch of times again than ever rewatch Epic Movie or The Love Guru, or Jack and Jill. Fuck me, no.
which is a conversation we have in our other podcast.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. That is true. You can listen to our Stopper or Mom Will Shoot episode in season 2 of the All 90s Action All the Time podcast, and you can hear more of us talking about those terrible, terrible films. The last kind of little note that I was going to make on the film is that the movie made $13.8 million at the World Box Office off of a $12 million budget, which is crazy, not just because, like, obviously it didn't make a lot of money off its budget, but because if you have seen the film, you will be staggered to hear that it had a $12 million budget, because it looks like it is made for about, it looks maybe 500K, maybe kind of trauma money.
Yeah, that's it, all went towards Clint Howard's paycheck, who's in it barely at all.
And Jürgen Prochnow, let's not forget him. I feel like, I mean, like, if we're kind of debating this, right? Because, like, Jürgen Prochnow, he was, like, in Death Boot and has been in several classy pictures, you know, bigger budget pictures, whereas, like, Clint Howard has mainly worked in direct-to-video. So, like, I feel like Jürgen Prochnow's check would have been bigger. Like, his appearance money is probably bigger, right?
I'd think so, but it's weird because Clint Howard has, like, he's one of the top-billed people, even though he's in it less than almost any of the rest of the cast. I think he's third billed or something.
Yeah,
which is strange, but
it's kind of odd. And,
yeah,
well, maybe because like it feels like they would draw a genre audience, because like he's in like a lot of horror movies and stuff like that, so maybe they think his name is a draw.
And Ron Howard's brother.
Well, he is indeed Ron Howard's brother. Maybe he gets like to, maybe his check was bigger. Like, maybe, you know, he gets like a lot of leverage based on being Ron Howard's brother.
He was in The Grinch with Jim Carrey.
Yeah, I mean, like, but that's just a thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you've got a brother, you know, you gotta give him, you gotta give him some work.
Exactly.
You know, like, you gotta keep it in the family. It's a bit like, you know, Sean Gunn being in all of James Gunn's movie, or Ted Raimi being in all of Sam Raimi's movies, you know?
Exactly.
You know, like, you gotta give your family gainful employment.
Yeah.
That is no offense to Sean Gunn or Ted Raimi or Clint Howard, all of which I think are fun screen presences. So I'm not meaning to talk shit about any of them. I'm just saying, like, you know, keep it in the family. Nepotism. It's the way to go. Oh, dear. Anyway, I suppose we should start talking about this start of the movie. Like, because I've done this before with other episodes. Like, I recently, the previous month's episode on Van Helsing, like, there was this big tangent that me and my guests, Graham Hughes and Lex Jones, went on about the MCU. And then, so, like, you know, takes a little while to get the start of the movie. So we're gonna hit the ground running, sort of, and get into the movie. How do we start the movie, Craig?
We start with basically a great techno beat, which is to show us that this is a post Matrix early 2000s movie. And then we get negatives of the game, or also little clips of the game that, you know, flash throughout. For those that don't know, House of the Dead was an arcade game. It was one of those ones where you just kind of walk through and you press the button to either hide or pop up, and, you know, you have the guns to shoot, stuff like that.
I feel we should point out that in between, like, the first credits and the title card coming up and the, you know, going over the kind of distorted game footage, the movie kind of makes us believe it has started, because we get an opening scene and then we cut back to credits.
Yes, and that's where we get Rudy.
Yes, we are introduced to, we don't know that he's called Rudy at the time, but we are introduced to Rudy, played by Final Destination 2's Jonathan Cherry.
So Rudy talks about how basically being very ominous about what is about to happen, and without giving too much away, and, you know, he's going to be narrating this story, and he plays a bigger role in the video. I guess he's kind of connected to the actual video game itself, his character, but the rest of it isn't connected. I don't know.
But we do not find that out to the end, and it makes no difference to the plot.
And especially for the fact that the game isn't popular enough to, I think, really be as big of a reveal
reveal
as big of a reveal that it's trying to be.
That is true. Like, yeah. I remember playing like House of the Dead in arcades, but like I didn't remember the character, the reveal that we'll talk about at the end. I didn't remember that was like, you know, that character. I was like, oh, okay, I had to look it up and stuff, you know, like and in the actual game, turns out like he has a different first name. The character's first name in the game is Roy, not Rudy. Don't know why they changed it, but then again, don't know why they did Mitch thing in this movie. So like, we'll skip along.
Anyways, that techno beat though in credits,
that techno beat, that incredibly generic sub prodigy techno beat.
Then it pretty much takes us again to, is that where we, because that
this is where we get the, after the credits we get the freeze frame character intros. So
yes, okay, that's what I was trying to remember, because it jumps back and forth so much in this movie really quickly that I didn't remember if we see the rave that is supposed to be in this exotic area. That doesn't, it looks like it was,
oh no, no, we don't, we don't yet. See the, okay, with like, yes, it does kind of come back and forth quite quickly, but no, we first,
this is when they're getting on
we get title card, cheesy narration, some in-game footage, distorted in-game footage, where you hear one of the characters from in-game saying like, stop Kurian, who will he turn up in the movie, will it be important to the movie? No it will not. Kind of, it's, anyway, it's a thing. And then we cut to freeze frame character intro. I love when cheap movies do this. It's just like, we're just going to explain who all the characters are, and we need to, because the characters are so unmemorable that even with these freeze frame character intros, you're still going to forget their names.
Yes, because they're also very generic names too, like for, and just everything about it and how it's explained. It's, and the characters don't necessarily even fit how they're described at points, and I don't know, but
I tell you who does fit who they described, and that is Karma. Karma in the opening narration is described as a woman who thinks she's Foxy Brown. And yes, dear listener, she is just written as the most generic sassy black woman you've ever seen.
Yeah, but then she's not like, so they throw in all this, but then they don't live up to it, and that, to the point that you would expect, I guess, in a either a comical way or whatever, because Simon is described as this kind of, well, he's an underwear model, we'll get into that later on, but that he's kind of this cocky, very handsome man who is also very dumb, and it's referred to constantly throughout the movie how dumb he is, even though he's not, he never does anything that's that necessarily stupid that I know.
No, he doesn't come across any dumber than any other character in this movie.
And then you get Greg, who Rudy used to play ball with in college, and he's supposed to be like the jockey one, but he's kind of the like the joke character where he's always getting goo all over him or stuff like that.
Yes,
and which is, I guess, they're the joke for it.
He
vomits, or he gets seasick, and then I can't remember the name of his girlfriend or for some reason.
Rudy's ex, I mean, if I hadn't written these down, I probably wouldn't remember either, but I do have them written down, so that's okay. So Rudy's ex is called Alicia, and is played by an actress called Una Grower.
Okay.
I think that's how you pronounce her name. So, yes.
Yeah, and she's supposed to be a fencing star, which is foreshadowing.
Yeah, that turns out important piece of information right there in that opening freeze frame narration.
Yeah, that pops up all of 5 seconds towards the end for one little brief scene.
Yep, it was well worth it. Yeah. That foreshadowing was totally, absolutely worth it.
And then there's Greg's girlfriend, who, again, that's one of the names I forgot to write down.
Cynthia. Greg's girlfriend is called Cynthia, and is played by Sonia Solomo. And I noticed, like, I was kind of looking at, you know, I kind of, doing these episodes, I kind of fall down these holes of looking down people's IMDb credits, and I noticed that a lot of the actors in terms of the younger cast, a lot of them, the film was mainly shot in Vancouver, and a lot of them are Vancouver based, and a lot of them, their credits are kind of bulked out by TV shows that filmed in the kind of British Columbia area. So like, you know, Stargate and its spin-offs, Smallville, a bunch of other shows, you know, stuff like that.
Also known as Hollywood North. I don't even know if it's still called that, but yes.
I don't know. But like, yes, I know like loads of TV shows and stuff like that get like filmed in Vancouver.
Oh, and it should be a spoiler, but it's not because he says it. Rudy, in his narration, also mentions that if they didn't get on the boat, then they would all still be alive today. So, you know, right off the bat that they are not going to make
it. The really hilarious thing about this is in the, like, basically we see a scene of them missing the boat to the rave. Then they have to go and get another boat. We'll talk about that more in a minute. But they miss the boat for the rave and they're like, damn, we missed the boat. And then we get a freeze frame and the narration says they missed the boat to the rave. If only they'd stayed back in Seattle, they still would have been alive. It's like, yes, we know they missed the boat. We don't need to be told in narration. We've just seen them miss the boat. And they said, we missed the boat.
Yeah.
It's like telling the street, I mean, come on. Anyway, I don't know, like, let's not get too hung up on all the silly things in the movie, because we're never going to get anywhere if that is the case. But this is where we cut to the rave, which is the biggest rave of the year. The biggest rave
in
of the year.
World.
Tell us the wild attendance of the biggest rave of the year, Craig.
So this is, it's constantly referenced as, like, as you said, the biggest rave of the year in the whole, not just the United States, but anywhere. This is the rave, and what there's maybe, it looks like it's in somebody's in the woods randomly, and I guess Vancouver, it could even be New England, somewhere where you wouldn't expect, I guess, the biggest rave of the year to be. Then it also, kind of fits, I don't, there's 20 people maybe, they make sure to have a, on the, next to the DJ, there's a topless woman, and just a couple tents are popped up, maybe one kind of beer tent too, and that's about it.
I was thinking I'd be generous. Maybe, I would say like there's maybe like 50 people there. I estimated attendance at 50, and I was also amused, and I'm sure they kind of insisted on this product placement, I was also amused that the rave was sponsored by Sega, who are well known for sponsoring raves.
Yeah, all the raves I've attended, it's always a Sega rave.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the same here. That's the same here in Scotland, man. You know, like, Sega raves are the thing. Like, the arcade shuts, and then the Sega rave kicks off. You know, the only better bit of product placement is like when this you know, it pans to the stage with the sign in the background. It just went... Sega. It may as well have them.
Yeah.
Ah, dear. But we must roll on. Roll on to the introduction of Clint Howard and Jürgen Prochnow. Yeah.
Who are both collecting, hopefully, a decent-sized paycheck, is what I wrote on it. Because Clint Howard, they're just, all of his lines, for some reason, seem to be, he repeats himself constantly. But it's not like he...
Yeah, I don't feel like this is the first time I've seen Clint Howard play a character like this who's just like super fidgety and is always kind of... doing that thing and just kind of repeating and is stumbling over words and stuff. But yeah, no, I'm sure they got like... And apparently they must have liked working with Uwe Boll because like they had worked... or with Uwe Boll on his previous film. So his previous film was a film called Heart of America, which is about a school shooting. And I, you know, I'm not checking that movie out. So this was his like first video game movie. Like he hadn't done a video game movie at this point. But anyway, Jürgen Prochnow and Clint Howard, and in fact, Will Sanderson, who plays Greg, they were all in that movie. So they must have got on well enough that they decided to work together again. And Clint Howard would go on to star in a few other Bowl movies. He was in Blood Rain, the Third Reich. Yes, that's right, people. There's three Blood Rain movies. And he was in a movie called Blubberella.
Oh, I remember that one.
Yeah, I remember the trailer for that one, but like at that point, I was like, I'm not. I have seen enough David Bowie movies. Like, what am I doing to myself? Like, all the kind of great directors I've seen nothing of, and yet I have seen this film. I have seen Alone in the Dark. I have seen Blood Rain. I think I even saw the second Blood Rain, and I have also definitely also seen In the Name of the King. So, yeah, I've seen like 4 to 5 Uwe Boll movies. Yeah, I do think I saw the second Blood Rain. So, yeah, God almighty.
I've only seen this, I think, the first Blood Rain, and then Rampage. I must say.
Oh God, I've seen Rampage too.
Yeah, there you go.
My God, no, I no more. I will not watch another one of them. They're all terrible. Yeah. I mean, by comparison, Rampage is like okay-ish, but like it's just by it's still shit. But it's just by comparison, it seems like, well, this is a masterpiece.
Yeah. If that's considered as masterpiece, then,
you know. I must say though, this is probably his, like, even by his standards, this is probably his worst film. And this is like, I don't think it's the worst film ever made, but I do think it's the worst video game movie ever made. And making that comparison, considering video game movies and their shit history, I mean, you're really saying something. I mean, if, dear listener, you have not seen this film, by comparison, Super Mario Brothers, Street Fighter, these are like the Citizen Kane and Godfathers of video game movies in comparison to this film.
But this one, it plays, and we'll get into it once the action really starts, but it's like they didn't make a movie. They like went going, okay, how does a video game work in terms of its story structure? At least not nowadays, but you know, video games back then. Okay, yeah. So all you need is a wave of enemies. Okay, they beat the wave. Now give a little bit of exposition to move the plot forward. Okay, now we need a new wave and a new location because it's like a next level. And that is basically the structure of the whole movie.
Yeah, for sure. I want to kind of cut back to this scene of the introduction of Clint Howard's character and Jürgen Prochnow's character. So Jürgen Prochnow's character is, for comedy value, called Captain Victor Kirk. So yes, Captain Kirk. So there is a Captain Kirk joke, which he doesn't like. He's like, no, don't like those Captain Kirk jokes. No more of that. So that's not mentioned again. And the other thing that entertained me is like, yes, you know, because it's Jürgen Prochnow, somebody makes a U-boat captain joke. So it's like, yeah, because remember he was in Das Boot? And it's like, yeah, I suppose I could be watching Das Boot. Why am I doing
that? Yeah.
How have I got to this point in my life? Anyway, the other thing that I noted in the scene was like, so they're planning to take them to this island. They really want to go to this island for this rave. They don't want to take them to the island because it's the Isla de la Muertes, you know, the Isle of the Dead. And they're like, you know, all the money in the world won't get them to go there. But they up the price from like £300 to £1,000. And they're like, yeah, well, a grand. Sure, fair. Why not?
Yeah. And then, you know, because we learn that a lot of people are lost there later on. And he even pays them more money when the marshal, or like the Coast Guard, I can't remember what her title is specifically, but when she like just wants to do a routine inspection on a ship to make sure he's not, you know,
smuggling
anything.
Yeah. So I was a bit confused by that. I wasn't sure if he had actually given them more money or if he had just given them a full grand. Like, because there's a bit where Simon says, like, oh, I'll give you 500 now and 500 when we get there. I thought, like, he'd maybe just given them a whole amount.
Oh, no, I thought it was that he, like, offered them extra money to
extra
just,
money on top.
Yeah, okay. To just say to just loser or whatever. And then because he says the joke later on, or I guess it's, again, supposed to be a joke, and show how dumb Simon is, apparently, of saying that I would have done it for free to, like, lose her or whatever. Yeah. Because Simon's a dummy.
He's a big dumb. Anyway, we cut to some of this movie's great sleaziness.
Yeah. So obviously you need couples going out to go skinny dipping, you know, because they're at a rave and everything gets hot and heavy at a rave, especially on an island in the Vancouver.
Well, yeah, I think it's supposed to be some tropical islands, not supposed to be Vancouver Island.
But it doesn't look like a tropic island in the least bit. But so they go skinny dipping, and it plays out very much like a Jaws thing, where the guy, he steps in and he's cold, so he stays on the beach, and she decides to go and swim naked, and he kind of just passes out. And then we get something's under her, something's watching him.
Yeah, it's a little bit uncomfortable. Like, this scene is so gratuitously sleazy and doesn't need to be there. But it's just like, And also, like, the interesting thing to note about this scene is, like, so the character, the female character in the scene is called Joanna, and she is played by Erica Durance. And this was Erica Durance. He's only her second feature film credit, only her third credit on IMDb. And she would later go on to find fame as Lois Lane on Smallville, one of those many TV shows that are filmed in Vancouver. I'm sure she's not, like, she probably doesn't put this on a resume at all. And it does just feel like it really tacky. It's just like, it is just there so we can, like, pervin her and then pervin her underwater and then pervin her some more as she comes out of the water, and that's it.
Yeah. And then that's the scene. It doesn't really,
and it doesn't go anywhere. And it's just like, we had that. And then they both meet their doom.
And you don't even get to see, like, a real, it's, you know, just the flash away really quick with some screaming or whatever.
That's right. So we get Joanna, like, searching for Matt, who's disappeared from the beach by the time she's come out of the water. And then when she goes to the house of the dead, she just goes in. We see Matt very briefly, kind of a little bit bloody and obviously very much dead. And then she screams at that. You see a kind of hand come out to her, and she's obviously going to meet her doom as well. And then she screams, and then we kind of close up on her, and then we just cut to the boat. It's incredibly unsatisfying.
But I was curious if you noticed this, because I first did for the scene, and then afterwards, were they doing a lot of dubbing? Or because, I don't know, something about the audio seemed like actors were either dubbed, or there was a ton of, like, voiceover or recording after the fact or stuff like that.
Yeah, I think there was a bunch of, I think it's most notable in connection with the Coast Guard character, Casper. Okay. Yeah. Who's played by Ellie Cornell. Like, when she's on the pier, like, shouting at them, there's, like, ADR, and then there's like a really fucking random scene that's like, you're like, what? Where they're just, you get, like, the shot of their boat, of, like, the kind of Coast Guard boat, and you get this kind of mad ADR conversation, and you're just like, why would you insert that? There's literally no point of, and you just get this kind of weird disembodied voices coming from out the boat, and you're just like, so there's definitely some things going on. There's definitely a bunch of ADR and coming. For sure.
I didn't know if it was watching online and something, just maybe with
no I once again feeling depressed about life choices, but you know, like I rented this on Amazon Prime, so I paid my £3.49.
Me too, yeah.
And anyway, we should, and this at this point, like after we go from Erica Johansson's death, like back to the boat, I think this is where the first use of them using in-game footage from the arcade game, the original 90s arcade game, not even the like Dreamcast version of this game, but like the original 90s arcade game, like use in-game footage as like scene transition.
Yeah, in case you didn't know, it was based off of a video game.
Yes.
They really make sure from this point on to make you know that it's a video game.
Yeah, they hammer it home.
Yeah, and during that scene, we get to see Greg, who is brunt of all the jokes, and he is just seasick, and he's vomiting, and Cynthia is kind of either rubbing his back or things like that, but he ends up vomiting on her too, and she washes her clothes. I don't know. So again, another gratuitous one is that she's washing her clothes in the sink, which appeared dry later on and unmessed up. But as Clint Howard talks to her and gives her a cross to protect her and her friends from the evil
that they're going to face. But yes, again, after this point, the film isn't so kind of gratuitously sleazy. But she's just standing there like topless, being like, have you got, he's seen enough of the show, kind of like, and you're like calm down, movie, you know, it's just like see, you've seen a few slashes, you feel like you have to put this stuff in. There's even like another bit where there's like just before that where there's like this random couple having sex they're attacked, and it's just like that was an entirely necessary scene.
Yeah, and we talked about this before recording, but it feels like not like somebody's making a slasher movie or a horror movie in that sense, but that somebody watched like some cliche horror films and just took, like, just basically copied and pasted. Like, oh, this worked in another horror film, let's just put it on there without any reasoning. It's just, oh, boobs work, put boobs in there, or you know, stuff like that, or a sex scene. Yeah, okay, sex scenes. Those are popular. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, we finally get to the island after there's so much nonsense that's already happened, and we're not even that far in the movie. We're like less than 20 minutes in or something. But anyway, we finally get to this goddamn not tropical island, and it turns out that old Captain Kirk is a smuggler after all, after being like, oh, she's just after me, like talking about the sea cop, oh, she's just after me because I didn't join the serve, you know, like I didn't want to serve Uncle Sam and all this kind of stuff after it came out of the army or whatever. But no, it turns out he actually is a smuggler.
Yes. Not just any smuggler, but for the sake of the plot, he's a gun smuggler.
He's smuggling all sorts of things. Smuggling Cuban cigars.
Oh yeah,
he's smuggling all sorts. We should have mentioned that Clint Howard's character name is Salish. Not that is important, because his character disappears from the movie in about 5 seconds and doesn't reappear until the very end of the movie for about 5 seconds. So really doesn't matter. But anyway, thought I'd add that in there just for general information for the listener. Salish, character name.
Yes, which it sounds like in the beginning he's saying Sally, but it is Salish. True. And so their whole thing is while they're going to wait for these young people to go party and then they'll take them back later, they're going to use this as an opportunity to store all of their goods because they know that the Coast Guard is on them. So they'll store them and then come back like a couple weeks later and grab them. Then, I guess, is the plot for them. Because.
Well, yeah. Also, like, more on Simon being a dum-dum.
Yeah.
Like, he's a, you know, like, I can't really read the map right, But I did write in my notes, because I found it funny, was the you know something Alicia was saying, and I've written here in my notes. She mentions like that Simon's not a cartographer, and then everybody acts like this is, you know, just genius. You know, so I've written down, knowing the word cartographer makes you a genius, because obviously that just is, and then everybody talks about how clever Alicia is just based on this, and I'm like, I mean, I suppose it's a long word, you know, like, I mean, I feel like quite a lot of people probably know that a cartographer is somebody who makes maps, and I don't think it's that obscure knowledge, you know, to require this conversation of just how much of a clever clogs Alicia is.
Yeah, and I don't even know where to go with. Yeah, so the next up, and this is where it starts cutting back and forth between Salish, as you were talking about, who we kind of meet his demise, and then he's unloading the smuggled goods.
Oh, it's kind of hard to tell, because he's in the dark in the forest, and you just kind of like, we think he kind of maybe he just gets lost in the forest. I'm not sure what, like, because there's not like a kind of proper attack. You don't really see like a proper attack. You're just like, oh, okay, maybe something's happening. It's very poorly lit. Oh, okay, Clint Hurd's, bye.
Yeah.
Okay, you're not in the movie now. Okay. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I wonder, I don't know, it feels like one of those things where that they were trying to get him back. Yeah, I agree with that, where it's like, were they planning on, well, maybe he'll be like one of those surprise characters where you think they're dead, but then comes back.
Because it just kind of cuts away very abruptly, and you're just kind of like, oh, we saw some things rustling in the woods, and but I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not clear cut at all. So yeah, you do think he's going to come back earlier than he does, and maybe for longer.
Yeah.
But no, that's how much they could pay Clint Hurd.
Yeah.
So maybe he did get a bigger check, because Jürgen Prochnow's in way more of the movie.
Yeah. I mean, he's kind of the one of the leading forces.
Yes.
Really, if there really isn't a character that seems to be leading anything, but he does for a bit at least. He, you know, he's fun to watch.
Yes, he is fun to watch. I mean, I don't know if it's a necessarily a good performance, but it's certainly the best performance in this movie. I've obviously seen Jürgen Prochnow acting much better, but it is by far the best performance in this
movie. He's there, and that's all that matters.
He is doing his thing. And at least he looks like he's having fun smoking cigars and shooting the shit, you know? Like.
Yeah. So they end up getting to this ultimate rave area, which is just a couple of tents and a stage and a beer tent. And it is torn to shreds. And besides that, no, and all of these crowds of people are all missing. And there's barely any thought to it. They're just like, oh, okay, well, nobody's here, let's just party.
Yeah, more room for room for ourselves to party and dance all night. Like, one of my favorite, probably my favorite line in the movie happens here, is when Alicia picks up a bloody t-shirt and says, I think something bad happened here. And then everybody's like, what are you talking about? Oh, stop being such a square.
Yeah. And then they go on to make jokes about how the only bad thing the only bad thing is, oh, I don't think I can just live off this Bud Light. We need something else. That's it.
Oh, yeah. Simon complains that there's no mixers.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I can't just survive in Bud Light. I need me some mixers. Shut up, Simon.
But so those two scenes are basically going back to back a lot. And they decide to go, and because Greg and Cynthia are going to, you know, obviously they make it clear to their friends that they're going to have some alone time, that everybody else decides to, the three others, to kind of see what happened, or not even see what happened, but just see if they can find other people.
Yeah.
And then it becomes this really weird sex scene with the techno riff that
Oh,
goes
God.
really quick. And he does like that weird, Greg is trying to be what, sexy to her? Or he does like that jokey hump thing. I don't even know what he's doing. It's awkward. The whole thing is awkward.
It's very awkward. It's very awkward. And then she makes some comment about him, you know, like me surprising, like he, like basically a kind of premature ejaculation joke, which offends him. And then he needs to go for a pee. And then it's just like, what is going on? Why am I, what am I watching it? Like I've just, at this point, I've just put, God, these characters, like that's literally what I'm putting in my notes.
Then
talking about more random things as well. Like when they're walking through the woods. So Karma, Alicia and Simon are walking through the woods. And this doesn't happen again in the movie, but Simon like tries to sleaze on to Alicia, like using this posh English accent. And it's just like, where did that come from? And okay, it's just never mentioned again in the movie, because it just, she shuts him down and then he just looks kind of mopey about it and just kind of like, I thought it was kind of cool. Like that's his reaction. That's kind of like, that's not actually what he says, but that's kind of what it looks like he's thinking of, just being like, oh, I thought that was my best move. Oh.
Yeah. Because Simon is a jerk and a dummy. Yeah, and I just wrote, I don't know, in comparison, I, you know, we keep reiterating it, but in comparison to all the other characters, like he's supposed to be the obnoxious one, and you're kind of like, he's just like, he's on par with everyone else, but yet everybody just talks about how awful he is to his face.
That's true. I mean, he's not like, I feel like he is supposed to be the asshole character. He is supposed to be the you know, like the worst. And you're just like, he's just irritating like everybody else. Like he's not like uber obnoxious. Like it's not like when you watch like Cabin Fever and there's that fucking character, the squirrels are gay character, you know, like that guy. Yeah. He's super fucking obnoxious. Like most Eli Roth characters, but that's a whole other story. Anyway, you know, like, so yeah, he's supposed to be a character on that level, but he's like nowhere near that obnoxious, and he's just kind of like, yeah, he's kind of irritating, but then everybody's irritating in this movie. So I'm not kind of grinding my teeth going like, oh god damn Simon, I hope he dies first, because I'm like, yeah, I hope they all die. But I don't have any particularly passionate hate for any of them. I just think they're annoying.
So then with more cuts back and forth, we see Cynthia basically dying. Well, we see the tent being surrounded. Greg's not around. And with, you know,
oh, right. Yeah. So, like, we should probably cover, like, the two groups meet up, that like, Rudy and like his gang like meet up with Alicia, Simon and Karma.
Yeah,
so we meet a bunch of other characters in this moment, because they go to a house, they find a house, and then Rudy along with Liberty and a character called Hugh, who doesn't last long, played by Michael Eklund, who is one of those guys that you kind of just recognize from things. And also because he looks vaguely like Ethan Hawke.
Yeah, and he's supposed to be the, you'd think he'd last longer because he's the character that knows horror movies, and he, like, he's referencing Romero, and you know,
he's that character. You do feel like he's going to be the Jamie Kennedy character in the movie, and he's going to kind of riff on stuff as they go. But like, no, it's just they get that one horror reference in, and then like he dies very quickly after that. Oh, I do love, after Alicia being the one who's like being noted as the sensible one, the clever one, like when she watches Hugh's video of the zombie massacre of the rave, she's just like, nah, it's probably a prank, a promotional prank.
Well, I like too, because I guess in the video game sense of like, let's just get the plot stuff out, get to action, plot stuff out, action type of thing, it's basically they meet each other, there's a little tension. Then they're like, oh, let's show you what happened. We have it all on film right here. That they just like walk over and do that. There's no kind of in between.
Yeah.
Like filler of how do you get here? What, I don't know. It's just, okay, let's just move this along. Come on.
Yeah, no, come on. We've only got an hour and 26 minutes of this shit, you know, like we can't waste any time, you know, like just tell them what's going on. You took a video of it earlier, didn't you? Oh yeah, we also get like more gratuitous boobs of just being like, oh, look, oh, whoops, I'll skip, fast forward through that bit. Yeah.
So Rudy is kind of our main character, but not, I don't know. There's not really anybody, again, that's Dan. He's supposed to be, I think, our protagonist.
Yes, he is supposed to, him and Alicia are supposed to be the kind of lead characters, I believe.
Yeah.
Yes. And Jonathan Cherry's performance isn't good, but of the younger cast, he's probably the strongest performer.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess you could say that.
Like,
yeah.
In terms of levels of woodenness, you know, like the you know, no offense to Tyrone Letso who's playing Simon, or Will Sanderson who's playing Greg, or you know, any of the other characters, but you know, like Vinegar who's playing Alicia, like of the younger, you know, of those younger characters, they're all super wooden, and Jonathan Cherry is the all yeast wooden as well, but not quite as wooden as some of the other characters around him.
Well, it even comes up, I mean, we'll explain it later, when he's supposed to have his breakdown about not being able to save everyone, and it like it feels out of nowhere, but again, that's for later date because we'll get to that.
he's right. Obviously been practicing his middle distance brooding, you know, like middle distance brooding stare is what he was practicing for this movie, and it's not very effective, but you know, like it's funny.
Yeah, but that takes us to, okay, well, we have to now get off this island, get our friends, and this is all for the point of, I guess, moving the plot forward and getting another Greg covered in some bodily fluid joke.
Yes, because he got trapped in a port-a-loo that got pushed over, and now he's covered in shit, kind of. I mean, like, there's just kind of some brown stains on his shirt, and his, like, he doesn't, like, if a port-a-loo had tipped over, he'd be, like, head to toe, like, I suppose let's not question the logic of this film, but it's just, like, some kind of light brown stains on his shirt. It's not like he's like covered.
And our the good old nerd dies by Cynthia, who is now zombified, and she snaps his neck. That's him.
And yes, and at this point, like Casper, who's like the sea cop, kind of becomes the main character as well. And I think in the rest of the movie, like her acting gets slightly better, but in this scene it does look like she's reading off the camera. The actress is Ellie Cornell, who doesn't have a whole lot of credits, but is most famous for playing the character of Rachel Crothers in Halloween 4 and 5. So there you go. She is terrible in this scene. Like her line reading is so wooden. It's just every word is said like this. We need to get to safety. You know, it's just like, what? I mean, are you just reading off the camera? Like, I don't know. It just stood out to me. I don't know. Like, was it the same to you?
Yeah. No, I agree completely. I don't know. But again, it's so hard because all of them are so wooden.
Yeah, that's fair.
by like a certain point, you just kind of like, okay,
yeah, you gloss it over at a certain point. Like maybe nobody's acting gets better during the course of the film. I just accept this level of woodenness at a certain point of just being like, yeah, I've let it go now. Like the acting is awful. So like. Oh dear.
So they go to they're going to Kirk's boat because it's supposed to be closer than the I guess hers, from what I'm guessing, or something, because she was parked on the opposite side of the island.
Correct.
A scene that, again, was in voiceover and purposeless, but yeah, plot reasons, I guess. But they go to the boat and they're yelling, and they see that there's some figures on the boat. And because Simon's a dum-dum, he's running off the deck to jump into the water to swim toward the boat. But then the zombies start swimming towards him, and that's where, again, we get one of those nice little stereotypes, because Liberty happens to be an Asian American, that she knows like martial arts, and so she's fighting these zombies in the water to save Simon, I guess.
Because of course she does, because yeah, it's the early 2000s. Yeah.
And people have watched Matrix movies, but it was,
yeah,
a big
people thing. Have watched Matrix movies, yeah. Right? Like, so it's like, oh yeah, she's like the Michelle Yao, Lucy Liu character of the movie, yeah. With, and yeah, she's in like this all American like one piece as well. It's,
yeah,
like, it's certainly an outfit choice.
Yeah, the whole thing I actually wrote early on, I forgot to mention, was all that great early 2000s cinema fashion. It's not like what actual people wore, but just like in those movies that came out during that time.
Oh man, yeah, like I mean, I love covering some of these early 2000 movies. Like a couple episodes ago, we covered Ghosts of Mars, and
yes,
it's got some, you know, it's got all that kind of post Matrix, everybody in leather trench coats, like yeah, like Ice Cube is just like wearing a vest and a, you know, black vest and cargo pants. Oh, it's awesome. Early 2000s film fashion, man, it's the best.
I don't know who was pushing all that fashion. Like somebody, it's like, yeah, let's get all the kids to start wearing this stuff because that's cool.
It does make you think though, like when was the last time like certain things happened? Like I remember when I was like in my teens and super into new metal,
yeah,
like, and I had like the baggy pants and the massive wallet chain. You're like,
yeah,
I wonder when the last time somebody wore like a massive wallet chain. Or like talking about like movies and stuff, like I suppose this is more like a 90s thing, but you know, I kind of like, you know, kind of late 90s thing, but you know, I wonder when was the last time someone wore a backwards Kangol hat.
Oh yeah,
you know, these are the kind of things I think about, listening. Yeah.
That are way more exciting than the movie that we are talking about. Let's just do an episode on that.
Early 2000 fashion choice.
Yeah.
I mean, I could do an episode on early 2000s film fashion. Like, also, like, another movie recovered as part of this series, Dracula 2000.
Oh,
it is. It's full of great early 2000s film fashion. Oh, it's amazing. But we should really go on back to, yes, talking about this movie.
Yes, because that's when the wave comes, I think. The first, what I put is the video game, like, wave of, you know, villains or whatever you want to call it, because Kirk comes in and they start shooting. They kill them all off, the zombies that are there.
Yeah, and we then, get, like, yeah, we get... our first kind of zombie head explosion. We get a bunch of them. We get an underwater zombie fight and stuff.
Yeah.
Which is very kind of like felt, I don't know if it was like a deliberate zombie flesh eaters reference, but like it just reminded me of that. And yeah, we got a bunch of incomprehensibly edited action.
Yes. And then it is quickly over. And oh, we get to see who actually pops up earlier on within the movie too, the Frankenstein looking, I put Peeping Tom, who has the same like couple shots but appears throughout the movie. It's like he's just looking at them behind a tree and you can clearly see his face, so it's not, you know, that he's some shadowy figure, but
yes,
he's just watching them.
Yes, and he is kind of the big bad of the movie. And we get a kind of, well, after the fight has ended, so Captain Kirk has been bitten, and
yes,
Like, he is, yeah. So, and they have to kind of, you know, patch him up and generally recover themselves. Like, Simon, like, starts wailing on a zombie who, like, spits acid in his face.
I guess,
because it, like, burns his cheek off. And then, yeah, so they're kind of recalibrating their bearings. And then we get, like, a weird... So Jürgen Prochnow kind of gives us a kind of exposition dump of the kind of the myth of the island, you know, because I think it's Alicia says, like, oh, your first mate, he seemed to know shit about this island. And old Captain Kirk's like, oh, that's just myths, and, you know, old sea dog tales or old wife tales or something. And then we get an utterly pointless flashback, which doesn't actually explain anything, because it's like they're trying to explain the origins of what's all these zombies. And then he tells a story about the big bad of the film, Castillo, just coming over to the island. He's a prisoner on a ship. He's been doing wacky experiments that's got him in trouble with the church. So he has been exiled from Spain and is going to be dumped on an island or something, I think. And then he kills the captain of the ship. And in the flashback, we just see him kill the captain of the ship. Do we get any explanation about any zombies or the experiments he's doing? No, that's the entire flashback, and we get no further information. So we're really no further forward.
No. Yep. I think we do learn that he killed everybody else on the ship too.
Asked about the zombies. Like, that's not explaining shit. Like, it doesn't. Yeah. Like, this guy is come to the island and he's apparently been killing people since. Yeah. And none of the characters question that. They just, like, go along with it as if they've learned something about, like, the zombies that they're facing, but which they have not.
So that happens, and then immediately before anything else can get solved, we get one of the many techno chases through the woods at night, is what I called it, which just means they're being chased through the woods and it's playing that same techno riff.
Yeah, but this is the really annoying one that's like that's just like a close-up of, like, Greg's face. That's just like you know, like, it just focuses on that, and, you know, like, shudders up and down, and, you know, like, it's just like, this is shots annoying me.
Well, and this actually so Greg goes off with Casper because he's not medically trained and he's not injured, so he's supposed to kind of team up with her. She tells him to run. He does more running, and then it made me realize how many Lord of the Rings references there are.
Oh, yeah, because he hides behind the tree. And, yeah, I saw, like, a little kind of highlight of on YouTube of some commentary, director commentary of Rubo, and that was a very kind of deliberate Lord of the Rings reference for no reason.
Okay, because there's also a joke I remember earlier on where they make a Lord of the Rings joke.
Yeah.
It's somebody's at Spence. I can't remember it now. But yeah, this one, it's like the... I don't even, when the ring race are looking over the ledge and the hobbits are hiding.
Yeah, hiding under the tree in the Fellowship of the Ring. Yeah, yes. That's what we're referencing. Go.
Okay, so after that reference that is kind of unimportant, except to, I guess, bank off of the movie that was far more successful, we get Greg stepping on a branch, all of them coming after him again. He runs a little bit more. Finally, he gets cornered, surrounded, and Greg gets killed. And he's given the first of many video game-style deaths, where it shows the person standing there, and then the screen kind of turns red. And in a video game, as always, it would say, do you want to continue, or stuff like that. It doesn't in here, but it's that type of look.
It's that type of look of, like, a kind of game over screen. And yes, we get one of the many kind of 360 shots in the movie. Yeah. So it's a freeze frame, it's 360, but with this kind of, you know, red red filter of kind of like game over. That's but also before we get the game over shot, I also put ninja zombies kill Greg. Oh, yeah. Because I'm not a zombie purist by any measure, you know, like I do prefer the kind of Romero zombie, but you know, I can take a running zombie or whatever. But these zombies are just jumping about, doing fucking backflips, you know, parkour. Like, you know, like, yeah, you know, like these zombies attack like the putties in Power Rangers is is the closest analogy I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, no, it, I mean, that is pretty reference for it.
So I was, you know, like, I have seen this movie once before, but it's still kind of, I was like, what? It's just like gonna cartwheel onto the screen and just be like, eh, what? Zombies can do that? Okay, sure. You know, like, and there's obviously, I think you can kind of, like later on, we'll get to the kind of big action scene later on. But there's clearly like kind of clearly placed trampolines. Yeah.
Well, you know how raves just like that's full of trampolines. Yeah. Sega like, and trampolines or what?
Yeah, that's true. I've not been a lot of dance parties, but all the ones I have been, definitely sponsored by Sega, definitely had those kind of mini trampolines so you can be a ninja. But yeah, so there you go. In case you've never, people out there listening have never been to a dance party, that's definitely requirements. but we should probably mosey along. Yeah.
What I will say too, kind of rehashing all this stuff before and trying to explain it, is I know we were talking about this before recording, of like what I'm realizing is so difficult to talk about this movie is how many cuts there are and how much like it does jump back and forth, where you get the same,
oh yeah,
where you get like, you know, the Greg stuff, but then there'll be another scene going on as well, or the same as we were talking about the one group,
yeah, because we cut back and forth to
so much.
Yeah, it cuts back and forth tons of like we're cutting back to the group, you know, with Rudy, you know, kind of patching up Simon and patching up Jürgen Prochnow, and yeah, like this is all happening. The stuff with Island flashbacks all happening, and we're cutting to like Casper looking for Greg and Greg being attacked, and like, yeah, it's a mess.
Yeah. So for anybody listening who's like, what are they even talking about by that point? That is why what I'm just trying to say.
That is true. We are trying to give you this plot breakdown as coherently as we possibly can based on the material in front of us.
So Casper comes back to the group and they ask where Greg is at. But, you know, Greg is obviously a very good friend of theirs, all that. And it just seems like in many of the scenes that they are all just kind of reading lines right from, as you were saying, like the monitor or right from the script or something. Like, oh, okay. So if you guys don't even feel bad that your best friend is dead, then I guess I won't either.
Yeah, and they like, yeah. I noticed as well at this point, like, one of the things I noticed was like they keep saying Greg. Yeah. Like, after the point where Casper first takes him into the woods to being like, oh, you're going to, you know, you're coming with me, you know, what's your name? And he's like, my name is Greg. And then, like, it's said like a million times after that. I was like, I feel like it's not been, you know, apart from the freeze frame intro narration, I feel like it's not been said up to this point, and now it's being said every 5 seconds. Wait, yeah. Greg, where's Greg? Is Greg okay? And we haven't seen Greg. Oh.
Because again, there's like a payoff later, yes, but it's not even worth it.
It's really not.
Like most of the stuff in this. But anyways, we get, because, you know, they have to get to a certain area, next level is coming up, we get a montage of they opened up the gun case and now they're all going to be professional gun shooters.
Yeah, most of them have never shot a gun in their life, don't even know what half the guns are called or what they are and how to hold them, but 2 seconds later, fucking marksman experts.
And they all know martial arts, and
yeah, for sure they do, of course,
because that's what happens when you have a handgun, is what I heard.
Yes, as soon as a Desert Eagle is put into your hand, suddenly you become an action movie hero, I guess.
Yeah, and yeah, that's what I wrote immediately after that. In case you didn't know, it was based off of a video game, the attack to get to the church, and then we get the glorious freezing of characters, and, the turntables, and everything you've been mentioning up until this, hinting at up until this point.
Oh, this is where the turntables are in full effect. So, I mean, there's a lot to deal with in this scene. The fact that there's so many of these 360 freeze frame things, there's so much. We've talked about how, like, you know, it's like, oh, because it's the early 2000s. So we got bullet time, we got kung fu, you know, we got, like, we mentioned that the score up to this point has been kind of pumping techno, which is very early 2000s as well. But you know what? You know what's also very early 2000s? Yes, we've got a generic rap metal track.
That I feel like it repeats twice during this whole thing. It's either like has a long instrumental break or something, or it just repeats.
Because I was like, yes. Oh.
The song is still going.
Yeah, but then, like, I mean, that was my feeling about the action sequence as well, of just being like, the song, I feel like it, I feel like it repeats, but then the song ends and the action scene is still going, and then we revert to pumping techno. And we're like, Jesus, like, because you feel like when the song ends, you're like, oh, well, the action sequence is over because, like, yeah, we've come to the end of this. Oh, no. Okay, there's more. Right. We're just going to go back to the techno score and we're going to continue with that dramatic freeze frame, 360 spinning, incomprehensibly edited, interspersed with random game footage. Like, I don't even know what I'm watching. I do not even know. And, like, the funny thing is as well, like, I'm not one necessarily to kind of, you know, you see all those videos on YouTube and stuff of like movie mistakes and, you know, like, oh, you know, this character was wearing this jacket in one scene and then they were wearing this other jacket in the very next scene. Or they were like, their shirt was wet in here and like, now it's dry. You know, like half the time, like I don't pick, you know, like small kind of bullshit stuff up like that at all. But in this scene, it is like super obvious of like, so in the freeze frames, like they've got certain guns and that does not always match up with, you know, what they come out with in the kind of real time footage. So, which is, you know, because there's a moment where like Karma is holding like two Desert Eagles, it like freeze frames. And then when it comes back to real time, she's got like a shotgun in her hand and you're like, what now?
Yeah. So I didn't know, because when it does the freeze frame and the twirl, like you're, I guess if you're picking up the character you want to play or whatever, if that's what they're trying to accomplish there, if it was like, oh, they're changing their guns up, I was trying to give it more credit than I guess it ever will deserve or something.
I think you're definitely giving it more credit than ever.
My brain of trying to make logic sense of it.
You are just
misfiring,
filling in gaps. That are just gaps.
But not only that, we get the tiniest bit of break to then have again wave two, where now the zombies are carrying weapons.
Yeah, because apart from being ninjas, they can also like use axes and stuff.
And that's the only difference from now they have. And so when they first get see the area, the church itself that they're trying to get to is probably only 50 feet away. And you're watching them walk for, it feels like, I know it's not, but it has to be like a 7 minute to 10 minute scene. It feels.
Oh, no, I'm pretty sure it is. I'm pretty sure the action sequence lasts for about seven minutes of screen time. Okay. I think so.
Okay. Then it wasn't just me, because I was sitting there going.
No, it lasts forever. But no, I think legitimately, I'm sure I read in one of the articles I was reading about it that that scene is like 7 minutes Like what? Yeah. So like, no, it is like legitimately like 7 minutes of screen time.
Okay, then it makes sense. But we get not only that, not only this long fight, but then Liberty dies. Well, she's slowly dying, and Rudy seems to be upset because he's not saving her, and he's just kind of watching her slowly be eaten. He's just staring at her. But instead of doing anything more, he then replays in his head the entire fight in a flash. That then plays with this techno burst.
Yes. And it's like super sped. It's like the whole fight that we've just, the whole 7 minute sequence that we've just seen sped up backwards. So like, yeah, okay. We've literally just watched that. Okay, sure. He's just reliving the thing that's just happened in his head. That's okay. Sure. Yeah,
and she's like screaming or something like for him to help, but he's just kind of brooding. And
we've really deeply established the romantic connection between Rudy and
They're supposed to be a couple or like an, I don't know.
Well, apparently it's suggested in one of the many walking through the woods scenes earlier on in the movie that Liberty is Rudy's kind of rebound girl. That's
even though they never really
have any major interactions or anything else that suggests that. It's literally just that one conversation he has with Alicia implies that. And I mean, I suppose you could, if you're giving the movie some sort of credit, you could say that they're just, but he's just kind of bullshitting, but then it kind of doesn't make sense. If he's bullshitting like Alicia's bullshitting about Simon, then this scene doesn't make sense. So this scene suggests that it wasn't bullshit and he actually did have some fling with this girl. Anyway, like too much trying to implant logic on the thing. You've got me into it now, like this has happened before on other podcasts where you've tried to place too much logic on things that are completely illogical and can't have logic placed on them, and now I've been reeled into your game, Craig.
Yeah, sorry. That's just how it goes. This whole episode should have just been us sighing the whole time.
It's just one long sigh. Yeah. We can't just that's not going to be the most sound. I don't think that's going to get me a lot of download. Not I don't think that's going to increase my listenership any. Just like, this is our head to the end episode. Just me doing that for like an hour and 45 minutes.
So finally, after all this time, they get to the door, but it's locked. So now Rudy and Casper go around to the side, but this whole scene is like them taking their sweet time while everybody else is still being attacked and trying to fight off the zombies. And so they go find a window that they can kind of open up, go in, and then Casper is hacked apart. Well, her legs are hacked off. I guess you don't necessarily really see it, but you can assume that she's hacked in half.
That is true.
And
when she's pulled through the window, you can see that her legs have been hacked off.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be
by the axe-wielding zombies. Yeah. So it's implied that the zombies did not bite her legs off, that they were cut off by the axe that the zombie was wielding.
Yeah. And this, she's supposed to play like an emotional arc for Rudy later on. Not even later on, in like two scenes.
In like 2 minutes time.
Yeah. But again, I guess we'll get to that when it happens, because it will. But finally, he opens the door after kind of moseying around for them.
Taking his time, checking the joint out, being oh, this place looks kind of cool, kind of gothic.
Going to the bathroom.
Anyway, having a shave, regelling his hair, and then finally.
Yeah. And so they all come inside, and Kirk is in even worse condition than before, and they pretty much have to prop him up on the table to get him to just rest for the time being while they go and they look at all the other, what else is in this church or house of the dead.
Yeah. And then we get some like deep emotional character stuff with Simon, where he looks at himself in the mirror and for some reason the wound on his face has kind of changed kind of shape and size and like I don't know, like anyway, he's got a big gouge in his cheek now that doesn't look like the gouge in his cheek earlier that was more kind of melty. But anyway, doesn't matter. He looks at himself in the mirror and says, I look like the fucking elephant man. And, you know, he's worried about his all his gigs that he gets as the world's greatest underwear model. It's been established that he's the world's greatest underwear model. And yeah, but then he's reassured by karma and melodramatic kind of like, oh, kind of music plays, you know, that's like really kind of cheesy emotional music. And karma reassures him and they decide to get it on because that romance has been subtly seeded throughout the movie. So subtly so that you don't realize that these characters have any romantic connection at all.
No, the only stuff beforehand is you see like puts his arm around her as like a buddy thing. It never really seems, I don't know, like that's as much subtlety as they give.
Yeah. And then, as we said, it did happen 2 minutes later. So, like, so we get the thing with Rudy and Casper, where he puts the bag over, like, the kind of sack over her, and cover her up, be like, oh, she's dead now. I mean, he's all sad about that. Although, or is she? Because I looked at the cast list for the sequel, not seen the sequel, House of the Dead 2 from 2005, but the only returning cast member is, you guessed it, Ellie Cornell as Casper.
Then I won't watch it, but now maybe I'll read the Wikipedia or something if they have the synopsis.
They do have the synopsis on Wikipedia, so you can read the synopsis on Wikipedia.
Because now I really need to know what happened to Casper. But yeah.
Well,
so
do you know what? Like, actually, weirdly enough, the sequel to this film has a more starry cast than this film. Like, when I say starry, it is mainly like people you might recognize from television. You know, like like for example, Theo Rossi is in it. You know, from Sons of Anarchy, he plays Juice in Sons of Anarchy, and like he, you know, he's in like Luke Cage and stuff as well. And, you know, like Mercia Munro is in it, who was from a show called Episodes and has been in a bunch of other things. Nadine Velasquez, who was, I can't remember her name, like the cleaner character in My Name is Earl.
Oh, yep.
Yeah. Like she's in it. Billy Brown, who's also in Sons of Anarchy. He played, what was his character name again? I'm just trying to remember. August Marks. Okay. He was also in Sons of Anarchy. But it gets even fucking better. The rapper Sticky Fingers, isn't it? And topping it all off, playing Professor Kurian, Sid Haig is in House of the Dead 2.
There we go.
What a cast. I just thought I'd mention that.
Yeah.
Oh dear. But anyway, now that we've had the big emotional moment with Rudy and Casper, because Rudy had a big emotional connection to Casper as well as Liberty, we get some reassurance from Alicia. And what happens?
Well, they have a smooching session, as I put it. They just kiss, and that's basically it. Even though, their relationship is supposed to be this very romantic one, this almost feels out of nowhere because none of the characters have
any chemistry.
Yeah. So.
Yes. But so it has been kind of established that they were formerly partners. They formerly had a relationship, but they broke up, and now they're reunited. What really amuses me about this scene, even more than the scene itself, is like the little commentary video that you can see on YouTube. Uwe Boll, the director, compares this scene to being something like it's being for like something from Gone with the Wind. Oh, and I was like, Jesus. Yes, Mr. Ball, exactly the same. The only thing that you can say about this movie that's better than Gone with the Wind is that it's considerably less racist. I mean, even with the Asian kung fu fighting stereotype and Karma being a, like, just stereotypical sassy black woman, still less racist than Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
So well done on that one.
So he has that thing on it. so this gives, after they all kiss because plot says so, they decide to explore the house. And I wrote, explore the house, ... because instead of like trying to barricade themselves up more, and Casper has talked about how help will arrive in the morning, all this stuff, they don't take her advice because she's dead now. So why should they?
Oh, well, apparently not.
Yeah.
Returns in the sequel.
Yeah. So they find the science lab, kind of science lab, which is a lab because there's jars with things in it. And
with very brightly colored liquids. So that's what a lab is. So that's why I put discovered Castillo's lab. I also wrote down in my notes, so they discover like a book, like a kind of, that tells them a little bit of the history of the island that retells the exact same information that they got from Captain Kirk earlier on in the movie. Yeah. So again, no more further forward, don't have any more information on the zombies.
Yeah.
We just know that Castillo killed the people on the boat and came to the island and has been killing since.
Yeah. And what's funny is there's a scene where she's flipping, the first scene she's flipping through the book, and the book, if you like look at all the pages she's going through, is completely empty.
Oh yeah, it's completely blank, and then she several pages in, she reaches a page that says something. But yes, there's a whole big section of the start of the book that's just empty pages. Yes, and you can clearly see nothing on those pages at all. Yeah. You could almost imagine like Uwe Boll, like you know, in the director's chair, being like, "Yeah, just keep going. Yeah, the prop is." Like, yeah, there is a written page, so just get to the written page and then you can pretend that you're reading from the book.
Yeah, they couldn't even just put some scribbles on the pages or something. Maybe they had to use
put scribbles on like two pages. Like this is like, she really has to go through the book, like being like, nope, not this one. Nope. Guys, are you playing a trick on me? Nope. oh, this one. So he was on the boat and then he killed the people on the boat. I don't know why I'm reading this information out because we already know this, but the script tells me that's what I'm supposed to do. Anyway, we should move on to the next scene.
Yeah.
Where Clint Howard comes back.
Yeah, because Kirk hears the tune that Clint Howard, I guess, likes to whistle.
Yes.
So, and again, because the script tells him to, he goes outside to see Clint Howard is now a zombie too, which makes him realize that he will be turning into a zombie because he's been bitten as well, I guess. And
presumably so.
Yeah. And he shoots Clint Howard, which they hear Rudy comes out, and I don't know. It's one of the, it's weird because they're just like talking for a bit with the door open and the zombies are all around, but nothing's really happening. The zombies aren't necessarily attacking, aren't enough of a threat, I guess I'll say.
Yeah, because like Rudy like shuts the door like real slow. He like just pops his head out and being like, oh, Captain Kirk, what are you doing? Oh no. Oh, damn. And then, like, the zombies, at this point, no more backflips and cartwheeling or any kind of trampoline action. At this point, they go back to being lumbering zombies. And Rudy's like, can they just stand in there? Kind of, and then eventually it's like, oh, well, suppose I better go back in.
And then Kirk decides to blow himself up, which backfires, I guess, not for all involved, but not for the sake of the script, to keep things moving along, because him blowing himself up blows the door open.
Yeah. So all the zombies fly in.
Yeah. And that is when they also, they're all rushing to the, back into the kind of laboratory. And there's like that fish thing that Karma shoots in the glass, and the blood that was in the tank awakens the bodies on the, that were on the ground.
Yeah, it reanimates
Yes,
the corpses. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
because of the science that has been labeled out very well. And yeah, that we get some more shooting, but this is where they kind of have to barricade themselves and they find a bunch of gunpowder.
Yes, which they need to set off. And then Simon is attacked and he has to have his heroic last stand. So
because he's the elephant man.
He is the one who sets the gunpowder off with his final shot. And from his final gunshot, we like follow the bullet trajectory in super, super duper slow-mo, which apparently, according to Uvibo, was a homage to Pearl Harbor and the way it follows the bomb.
Okay.
Another, like... Yes, it's a crappy movie being paid homage to by an even crappier movie. That's what you want. So that sets it off. It blows shit up, and then we're in the tunnel for more exciting action.
But what I like about is this whole scene. It blows up. They run downstairs, and then Karma makes sure to ask where Simon is.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Yeah,
it's like I'm guessing he's dead. You know. Yeah. Kind of blew himself, you know, like, sorry to break it to you. I mean, you were there, but like, oh, maybe you weren't looking or something. Yeah. I don't know, honestly, were you thinking about something else? But anyway, we get more action in the tunnel.
Yes.
And it's, I think, like, this is possibly of all the incomprehensible action sequences in the movie, because they're all intercut with, like, video game footage. I think because of the extra thing of all the zombies are, like, coming from the tunnel walls and are kind of covered in grass, and it's super dark, so you can't really see anything as well as it being annoyingly intercut with video game footage. So I think this wins the award for the most incomprehensible action sequence in the movie.
No, I agree completely. And they're doing the video game element. Again, if you've played House of the Dead, where they're just walking down the tunnel, they're shooting, then one of them would, Rudy will say, "Oh, I'm out." And then Karma will step forward and she'll shoot some, and that's basically it.
Yep.
Until they're surrounded by the men in rubber suits. I mean, zombie, brawler zombie. I don't
Very
even know what they're called.
Convincing zombies.
Yeah. Who, yeah, Karma has to sacrifice herself to, she tells them to go on and she'll handle it. And she, I guess, kind of fights them for a bit until she dies and gets her game over, kind of segue. But then immediately after, they are saved by Greg?
Question mark?
Yeah. So that is, yeah, which if he was going to save them, it seemed like he would have come like a minute late. He could have just saved all of them, but he was just waiting until she died.
But there is a twist in the tale, is there not, Craig?
Yeah. They follow Greg into a room, and they're talking to him, and obviously he's a very convincing Greg, because
he says nothing.
Yeah. And as we know from earlier on, Greg was very silent and didn't say anything at all, so it makes sense. But no, it's not Greg, it is
Castillo, the very firmly established villain of the movie,
wearing Greg's face.
Dun, dun, dun. And he like pulls it out, like it's proper, pulls it off like Mission Impossible style.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's not like the face is kind of misshapenly on, like it's not like done like a kind of Texas Chainsaw Massacre style deal, or like House of 1000 Corpses or anything like that. No, it's like a proper, like it is just Greg's face, and then he pulls it off like it was the kind of Mission Impossible thing, and it is entirely pointless, like because he is not convincing as quote unquote Greg, and he just wanted to, he was like, and then once he reveals himself, it's just like, ah, fuck it, we'll just capture you and tie you down.
He could have, that's the thing, is he wouldn't have even needed to be Greg, because I didn't even, I, as many times as I've unfortunately seen this, I forgot that he was pretending to be Greg. It's like, you could just be somebody. It's like, oh, I'm here to save you. And it, you would have had the same reaction. Like, the whole
That's
Greg
true.
Bit is
he could have
just,
just had his cloak up and just, you know, stabbed a few of the zombies, and they would have probably followed them anyway. It's, yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of played as if it's this kind of big reveal, but I, what, whatever, you know, it's just one of the many, many things in this movie that doesn't make sense. But now, I mentioned earlier that I thought possibly my favorite line in the movie was, I think something bad's happened here, when she picks up the bloody t-shirt. But I think actual my favorite line in the movie is the following exchange, where Rudy has been tied down to a table and says to Castillo, you created it all so you could become immortal. Why? And Castillo replies, to live forever. Yeah, no, we know that, Castillo, because he said in a sentence, immortal, he was saying, like, beyond that, like, why do you want to live forever? Like, what is the point of this whole experiment? Why are you creating these zombies? Like, why do you want to be the king of this island forever? Like, is there any greater plan? Like, are you thinking of, like, world domination at any point, or do you just want to be the king of this island? Like, we established that you are immortal. That's kind of fine. Like, we've got that out of the way. Nope, just to live forever. Yeah. Okay, we'll move on.
That was my one I was about to say that I wrote down. Yeah, it is just, it kind of, I think, encompasses this whole movie. It's change.
And also at this point as well, we get some dramatic flashbacks of, like, him creating the zombies, which feel like the flashbacks we should have got when Captain Kirk told the story, like, half an hour ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, but because there's no such thing as tension in this movie, they just immediately escape.
Yeah, and they drop a grenade, which then blows up what we assume the whole area. And as they go out the, I guess, the, you know, cellar door type of thing on into what we think is the freedom, and, you know, it's daytime and everything's okay. And they're kind of taking a breath. And this is where her fencing comes into play, even though
that carefully constructed foreshadowing that we mentioned earlier pays off. The big payoff. Tell us about the big payoff, Greg.
He comes up and, or because he's not dead, and he attacks both of them, and they begin to fight as Rudy has a axe, and then the other two are battling with swords, kind of very sloppily for somebody that is a fencing expert. And it looks like they're purposefully missing, is what I put. There's, like, whole points where Rudy with his axe is almost swinging upward towards, like, the sky. So it's very,
yeah, it's pretty inept fighting. Yeah
it's,
and not, we get more we get more use of the turntables and the freeze frames and the bullet time and all that stuff, of course.
Until she is stabbed pretty much right through the heart. She is just skewered, but Rudy then is able to run up and chop off his head. But that's not the end of it.
No, it's not. It's not the end of it.
His body then begins to start choking Rudy out, and then until she crushes his head.
Yes, yeah. She looks like she has been fatally wounded.
Yes,
he falls to the ground to her apparent death, but then she walks it off for 2 seconds, stamps on his head, which kills him, and then collapses dead again.
Yes, and then, yeah, she's walking around like if some, like a character who's maybe been stabbed in the stomach or anything. But it's very clear she was stabbed directly through the chest.
Yes.
And yeah, Rudy is just really broken up about her death.
As he has been so broken up about everybody, Liberty's death, Casper's death, because of these greatly established relationships we have in the movie.
And to the point that when help arrives, these agents, she isn't dead.
I mean, I think she's supposed to be dead. She's just not acting like she. I like the narration that ends the movie suggests that she is actually dead, but she looks like she's just kind of that way when somebody's like been, you know, had a gash in their leg or something, yeah, and the other character is kind of propping them up, you know, like, yeah, she looks like that, but I think she is actually supposed to be dead.
It's... Okay, because I thought there was a whole, I could have imagined it in my, whatever, watching this, in my hallucinations, but I thought they were asking about her to, like, I don't know, because yeah, he's walking with her on her shoulder.
Yes, not, like the agent, arm arm. Like the agent Rogan, he does seem to ask if she's okay, and he says, "Does she look okay?" And like Rudy says, "Does she look okay?" Which I think is supposed to suggest that she's dead.
Okay,
and then like the ending narration, because we get we end how we begin with kind of pointless waffly narration, and he's kind of like, oh, what have I done? Like, so it kind of suggests in the end of narration that he has reanimated her for reasons that will become apparent in a second. But yes, so that is the suggestion in the ending narration as far as I picked it up. Again, okay, just filling in gaps here.
Okay. Yeah, so, but this is the key moment that we have been building up for.
The big reveal that we've, the whole movie we've been waiting for.
He's kind of avoiding giving them answers. They ask what his name is. He says Rudolph, which I'm guessing Rudy is short for, or yeah, he's just being cheeky. And then, yeah, his last name is Kurian, or whatever. Yeah.
As we all know, is the big bad guy in House of the Dead. And this has been a prequel to the game. And this has been an origin story of his villainy, which is apparently a different origin story to his villainy than actually happens in the game. But I suppose that doesn't matter because nothing matters in this movie. So,
yeah, but then we get some more flashes of the video game and credits. And
and that's it. We've done it. We've come to the end. We have covered House of the Dead. We have survived the House of the Dead.
And Clint Howard gets the third billing on his on the credits.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Despite appearing in all of like what, four scenes?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, if he's in it for like more than, is it even 10 minutes of screen? I don't know.
Yeah.
And but anyway, yeah, that's us finished with this film. And I think on the Guilty Pleasure podcast, as much as it's been fun talking to you, Craig, we probably won't cover any more of Uwe Boll's film. We probably won't cover Alone in the Dark or Blood Rain, or unless there is particular demands and people want to, I'll set up, if you know, if people want to pay me and I can set up a Patreon and I can cover, I can cover Alone in the Dark, I can cover Blood Drain, nothing that's not horror. You can't make me do anything that's not horror, because that's the point of Guilty Pleasure Podcast. It's 21st century horror. So there we go. So, you know, you can't make me cover any of his crappy action movies. But anyway, if you are a listener and you do want to pay to hear bonus episodes of the Guilty Pleasure Podcast, then get in touch with me and I'll set up that Patreon and I will do that. But for now, this is the only Uwe Boll movie we will cover.
Just to, in solidarity, I'll join you too. But only,
well done, Craig.
Only if you're getting paid.
Yes, we want to be paid just like Clint Howard was paid for his role in this movie. But that is just our thoughts on House of the Dead. Please check in with your thoughts on House of the Dead. You know, like give us comments, and please do, as always, rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify. Is really the best way to support the show if you want the show to grow. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your pets, tell anyone. You know, like, check out, you can check out our regular interview episodes, New Horror Express, and more of these Guilty Pleasures. We've got a bunch of them now. This is our 13th episode in the series, and we are going to keep on trucking. Next month, we will be covering Blair Witch 2, The Book of Shadows, so you can look forward to that. So just to wrap up this episode, all it leaves me to do is thank very much my co-host Craig for coming on the show again.
It's always a pleasure.
And to thank you, listener, for checking this latest episode out. But until next time, see ya!